This is Jennifer Love reading to you some poetry and prose. My Mother Made a Meatloaf by Jack Prelutsky. My mother made a meatloaf that provided much distress. She tried her best to serve it, but she met with no success. Her sharpest knife was powerless to cut a single slice, and her efforts with a cleaver failed completely to suffice. She whacked it with a hammer, and she smacked it with a brick, but she couldn't faze that meatloaf. It remained without a nick. I decided I would help her and assailed it with a drill, but the drill made no impression, though I worked with all my skill. We chipped at it with chisels, but we didn't make a dent. It appeared my mother's meatloaf was much harder than cement. Then we set upon that meatloaf with a hatchet and an axe, but that meatloaf stayed unblemished and withstood our fierce attacks. We borrowed bows and arrows, and we fired at close range. It didn't make a difference, for the meatloaf didn't change. We beset it with a blowtorch, but we couldn't find a flaw, and we both were flabbergasted when it broke the power saw. We hired a hippopotamus to trample it around, but that meatloaf was so mighty that it simply stood its ground. Now we manufacture meatloaves by the millions all year long. They are famous in construction, building houses tall and strong. Do Not Be Afraid of No by Gwendolyn Brooks. Do not be afraid of No, who has so far, so very far to go. New caution to occur to one whose inner scream set her to seed for softer lapping and smooth fur, whose esoteric need was merely to avoid the nettle, to not bleed. Stupid like a street that beats into a dead end and dies there, and nothing left to reprimand or meet. And like a candle fixed against dismay and countershine of mixed wild moon and sun and like, a flying furniture or bird with lattice wing or gaunt thing, a stammer down a nightmare neon peopled with condor, hawk, and shrike. To say yes is to die. A lot or a little, the dead wear capably their eye. Enameled emblems, they smell, but that and that they do not altogether yell is all that we know well. It is brave to be involved, to be not fearful, to be unresolved. Her new wish was to smile, when answers took no airships, walked a while. Good Hot Dogs by Sandra Cisneros. 50 cents apiece to eat our lunch. We'd run straight from school instead of home, 2 blocks, then the store that smelled like steam. You ordered because you had the money. 2 hot dogs and 2 pops for here, everything on the hot dogs except pickle lily. Dash those hot dogs into buns and splash on all that good stuff, yellow mustard and onions, and fries piled on top, all rolled up in a piece of wax, paper for us to hold hot in our hands. Quarters on the counter, sit down, good hot dogs. We'd eat fast till there was nothing left but salt and poppy seeds, even the little burnt tips of French fries. We'd eat you humming and me swinging my legs. Maggie and Millie and Molly and May by E.E. Cummings. Maggie and Millie and Molly and May went down to the beach to play one day, and Maggie discovered a shell that sang so sweetly she couldn't remember her troubles, and Millie befriended a stranded star whose rays 5 languid fingers were, and Molly was chased by a horrible thing which raced sideways while blowing bubble sand. May came home with a smooth round stone, as small as a world and as large as a loan. For whatever we lose, like a you or a me, is always ourselves we find in the sea. From the book Politically Correct Bedtime Stories, Modern Tales for Our Life and Times by James Finn Garner. The Three Little Pigs. Once there were 3 little pigs who lived together in mutual respect and in harmony with their environment. Using materials that were indigenous to the area, they each built a beautiful house. One pig built a house of straw, one a house of sticks, and one a house of dung, clay, and creeper vines shaped into bricks and baked in a small kiln. When they were finished, the pigs were satisfied with their work and settled back to live in peace and self-determination. But their idol was soon shattered. One day, along came a big, bad wolf with expansionist ideas. He saw the pigs and grew very hungry, in both a physical and ideological sense. When the pigs saw the wolf, they ran into the house of straw. The wolf ran up to the house and banged on the door, shouting, "Little pigs, let me in." The pigs shouted back, Your gunboat tactics hold no fear for pigs defending their homes and culture. But the wolf wasn't to be denied what he thought was his manifest destiny. So he huffed and he puffed and he blew down the house of straw. The frightened pigs ran to the house of sticks, with the wolf in hot pursuit. Where the house of straw had stood, other wolves bought up the land and started a banana plantation. At the house of sticks, the wolf again banged on the door and shouted, little pigs, let me in. The pigs shouted back, go to hell, you carnivorous imperialistic oppressor. At this, the wolf chuckled and condescendingly. He thought to himself, they are so childlike in their ways. It will be a shame to see them go, but progress cannot be stopped. So the wolf huffed and puffed and blew down the house of sticks. The pigs ran to the house of bricks with the wolf close at their heels. Where the house of sticks had stood, other wolves built a timeshare condo resort complex for vacationing wolves, with each unit a fiberglass reconstruction of the house of sticks, as well as a native curio shop, snorkeling, and dolphin shows. At the house of bricks, the wolf again banged on the door and shouted, little pigs, let me in. This time in response, the pigs sang songs of solidarity and wrote letters of protest to the United Nations. By now, the wolf was getting angry at the pig's refusal to see the situation from the carnivore's point of view. So he huffed, and he puffed, and he huffed and puffed, then grabbed his chest and fell over dead from a massive heart attack brought on from eating too many fatty foods. The three little pigs rejoiced that justice had triumphed and did a little dance around the corpse of the wolf. Their next step was to liberate their homeland. They gathered together a band of other pigs who had been forced off their lands. This new brigade of porcinistas attacked the resort complex with machine guns and rocket launchers and slaughtered the cruel wolf oppressors, sending a clear signal to the rest of the hemisphere not to meddle in their internal affairs. Then the pigs set up a model socialist democracy with free education, universal health care, and affordable housing for everyone. Please note, the wolf in this story was a metaphorical construct. No actual wolves were harmed in the writing of this story. Mad Men by Billy Collins. They say you can jinx a poem if you talk about it before it is done. If you let it out too early, they warn, your poem will fly away. And this time they are absolutely right. Take the night I mentioned to you. I wanted to write about Mad Men, as the newspapers so blithely call them. So attack art, not in reviews, but with bread knives and hammers in the quiet museums of Prague and Amsterdam. Actually, they are the real artists, you said, spinning the ice in your glass. The screwdriver is their brush. The restorers are the true vandals. You went on slowly, turning me upside down. The ones in the white smocks, always closing the wound in the landscape and ruining the art of the mad. I watched my poem fly down to the front of the bar and hover there until the next customer walked in. Then I watched it fly out the door into the night and sail away, I could only imagine, over the dark tenements of the city. All I had wished to say was that art, too, was short, as a razor can teach with a blind slash. It only seems long when you compare it to life. But that night I drove home alone, with nothing swinging in the cage of my heart, but the faint hope that I might catch, in the fan of my headlights, a glimpse of the thing, maybe perched on a road sign or a street lamp. Poor unwritten bird, its wings folded, staring down at me with tiny illuminated eyes. Little Abigail and the Beautiful Pony by Shel Silverstein. There was a girl named Abigail, who was taking a drive through the country with her parents, when she spied a beautiful, sad-eyed, gray and white pony. And next to it was a sign that said, for sale, cheap. Oh, said Abigail, may I have that pony? May I please? And her parents said, no, you may not. And Abigail said, but I must have that pony. And her parents said, well, you can't have that pony, but you can have a nice butter pecan ice cream cone when we get home. And Abigail said, I don't want a butter pecan ice cream cone. I want that pony. I must have that pony. And her parents said, be quiet and stop nagging. You're not getting that pony. And Abigail began to cry and said, if I don't get that pony, I'll die. And her parents said, you won't die. No child ever died yet from not getting a pony. And Abigail felt so bad that when they got home, she went to bed. And she couldn't eat, and she couldn't sleep, and her heart was broken. And she did die, all because of a pony that her parents wouldn't buy. This is a good story to read to your folks when they won't buy you something you want. The Fairy's Child by Thomas Caulfield Irwin. Amid the nut grove, still and brown, the fairy's child is walking. List, list, as the leaves come down, to the sprites around her talking. Along the windy, waving grass, their evening whispers breathe and pass. From yon aged bending bough, their leafy language floats below. And now her head in the air 'tis streaming. Oh, who can tell what things she hears, what secrets of the fairy spheres that fill her eyes with silent tears. Sweet, wandering, fancy-charmed child, with cheeks so pale and eyes so wild, oh, what shall come of this lonely dreaming? Down by the sun-dry harvest road, through quiet evening's hours, she paces with her scented load of late-year moss and flowers. Blooms from the wood of every hue, moon pale, purple, jet, and blue, woven in bunches and lightly pressed upon her simple snowy breast, and through the brown locks wildly tressed, nodding in crownlets o'er her. And low is the cloud and ocean's brim, with moonlight has enriched its rim, a quaint wild shape with kindly eyes, and a smile like a star from the distant skies, goes tripping along the path before her. Now by her pillow small and white, mid faded leaflets lying, an eager star like a taper light, o'er the curtain's edge a spying. The scent of the broom buds fills the room, the window is full of the bare blue gloom, and by the low hearth ashily sinking, half asleep is the fairy winking. Out in the air there comes a sound of music eddying round and round, the ivied chimneys swooning near, the glassy pane and streaming clear, as moonlight into the little ear, like a shell in brown weed gleaming. And just as the first bird mounted high on the sycamore's tinkling canopy, sings to the first red streak of day, her soul with the fairy speeds away, o'er field and stream and hamlet gray, where the weary folk are dreaming. Letting the Air Out of My Tires by Nikki Giovanni. This is not a country song. I am not a Dixie chick. There is no creek rising. There is no moon weeping blood. No hound dog baying. No little old man at first light up to catch a speckled trout. I don't have a pickup truck. I don't do roadkill. My hair isn't big. There's no breast implant. I don't talk through my nose or have an American flag tattoo. This is more pitiful than Polly wanting a cracker or eggs that won't sunny side up. Sadder than grits that won't boil, or chicken wings that stick to the skillet. This is me, letting the air out of my tires, not loosening the lug nuts, not taking my spinners off. Certainly not being so rude as slashing these tires that have hardly been properly ridden. Just me gently allowing the air to escape, but saving that good rubber. Just me bent and crying, admitting the truth. We're not going anywhere. Thank God for Monday Night Football. Nothing to Wear, an Episode of City Life by William Allen Butler. Miss Flora McFlimsey of Madison Square has made 3 separate journeys to Paris, and her father assures me each time she was there that she and her friend Mrs. Harris, not the lady whose name is so famous in history, but plain Mrs. H. without romance or mystery, spent 6 consecutive weeks without stopping in one continuous round of shopping. Shopping alone and shopping together, at all hours of the day and in all sorts of weather, for all manner of things that a woman can put on the crown of her head or the sole of her foot, or wrap round her shoulders or fit round her waist, or that can be sewed on or pinned on or laced, or tied on with a string or stitched on with a bow, in front or behind, above or below, for bonnets, mantillas, capes, collars, and shawls, dresses for breakfasts and dinners and balls, dresses to sit in and stand in and walk in, dresses to dance in and flirt in and talk in, dresses in which to do nothing at all, dresses for winter, spring, summer, and fall. All of them different in color and pattern, silk, muslin, and lace, crepe, velvet, and satin, brocade and broadcloth and other material, quite as expensive and much more ethereal. In short, for all things that could ever be thought of, or milliner, modist, or tradesman be bought of, from 10,000 francs robes to 20 sous frills in all quarters of Paris and to every store, While McFlinsey and Vane storm scolded and swore, they footed the streets and he footed the bills. The last trip their goods shipped by the steamer Arago formed, McFlimsey declares, the bulk of her cargo, not to mention a quantity kept from the rest, sufficient to fill the largest-sized chest, which did not appear on the ship's manifest, but for which the ladies themselves manifested such particular interest that they had invested their own proper persons in layers and rows of muslins, embroideries worked under clothes, gloves, handkerchiefs, scarfs, and such trifles as those, then wrapped in great shawls like Circassian beauties, gave goodbye to the ship and go by to the duties. Her relations at home all marveled, no doubt, Miss Flora had grown so enormously stout, for an actual belle and a possible bride, but the miracle ceased when she turned inside out, and the truth came to light and the dry goods beside, which in spite of collector and custom house sentry, had entered the port without any entry. And yet, though scarce 3 months have passed since the day, this merchandise went on 12 carts up Broadway. This same Miss McFlimsey of Madison Square, the last time we met, was in utter despair, because she had nothing whatever to wear. Nothing to wear? Now, as this is a true ditty, I do not assert, this, you know, is between us, that she's in a state of absolute nudity, like Power's Greek slave or the Medici Venus, but I do mean to say I have heard her declare, when at the same moment she had on a dress which cost $500 and not a cent less, and jewelry worth 10 times more, I should guess, that she had not a thing in the wide world to wear. I should mention just here that out of Miss Flora's 250 or 260 adorers, I had just been selected as he who should throw all the rest of in the shade by the gracious bestowal on myself after 20 or 30 rejections of those fossil remains which she called her affections, and that rather decayed but well-known work of art which Miss Flora persisted in styling her heart. So we were engaged. Our troth had been plighted, not by moonbeam or starbeam, by fountain or grove, but in a front parlor, most brilliantly lighted. Beneath the gas fixtures we whispered our love, without any romance or raptures or sighs, without any tears in Miss Flora's blue eyes, or blushes or transports or such silly actions. It was one of the quietest business transactions, with a very small sprinkling of sentiment, if any, and a very large diamond imported by Tiffany. On her virginal lips, while I printed a kiss, she exclaimed as a sort of parenthesis, and by way of putting me quite at my ease, you know, I'm to polka as much as I please, and flirt when I like. Now stop, don't you speak, and you must not come here more than twice in the week, or talk to me either at party or ball, but always be ready to come when I call. So don't prose to me about duty and stuff. If we don't break this off, there will be time enough for that sort of thing, but the bargain must be that as long as I choose, I am perfectly free. For this is a sort of engagement, you see, which is binding on you, but not binding on me. Well, having thus wooed Miss McFlinsey and gained her, with the silks, crinolines, and hoops that contained her, I had, as I thought, a contingent remainder, at least in the property and the best right, to appear as its escort by day and by night. And it being the week of the Stuckup's grand ball, their cards had been out for a fortnight or so, and set all the avenue on the tiptoe. I considered it only my duty to call and see if Miss Flora intended to go. I found her, as ladies are apt to be found, when the time intervening between the first sound of the bell and the visitor's entry is shorter than usual. I found, I won't say I caught her, intent on the pier glass and undoubtedly meaning to see if perhaps it didn't need cleaning. She turned as I entered. Why, Harry, you sinner, I thought that you went to the Flashers to dinner. So I did, I replied, but the dinner is swallowed and digested, I trust, for 'tis now 9 and more. So being relieved from that duty, I followed inclination which led me, you see, to your door. And now will your ladyship so condescend as just to inform me, if you intend, your beauty and graces and presence to lend, all of which, when I own, I hope no one will borrow, to the Stuckups, whose party, you know, is tomorrow. The fair Flora looked up with a pitiful air and answered quite promptly, Why, Harry, mon cher, I should like above all things to go with you there, but really and truly, I've nothing to wear. Nothing to wear? Go just as you are. Wear the dress you have on, and you'll be, by far, I engage the most bright and particular star on the stuck-up horizon. I stopped for her eye. Notwithstanding this delicate onset of flattery, opened on me at once a most terrible battery of scorn and amazement. She made no reply, but gave a slight turn to the end of her nose, that pure Grecian feature, as much as to say, how absurd that any sane man would suppose that a lady would go to a ball in the clothes, no matter how fine, that she wears every day. So I ventured again. Wear your crimson brocade. Second turnip of nose, that's too dark by a shade. Your blue silk, that's too heavy. Your pink, that's too light. Wear tulle over satin, I can't endure white. Your rose-colored, then, the best of the batch. I haven't a thread of point lace to match. Your brown, more antique, yes, and look like a Quaker. The pearl-colored, I would put that plaguey dressmaker, has had it a week. Then that exquisite lilac in which you would melt the heart of a Shylock. Here the nose took again the same elevation. I wouldn't wear that for the whole of creation. Why not? It's my fancy. There's nothing could strike it. Is more comme il faut. Yes, but dear me, that lean, sophronia stuck-up has got one just like it. And I won't appear dressed like a chit of 16. Then that splendid purple, that sweet Mazarine, the superb point de guile, that imperial green, that zephyr likes tarlatan, that rich grenadine, not one of all which is fit to be seen, said the lady, becoming excited and flushed. Then where, I exclaimed in a tone which quite crushed opposition, that gorgeous toilette which you sported in Paris last spring at the grand presentation, when you quite turned the head of the nation. And by all the grand court were so very much courted, and the end of the nose was portentously tipped up, and both the bright eyes shot forth indignation as she burst upon me with a fierce exclamation. I have worn it 3 times at the least calculation, and that and the most of my dresses are ripped up. Here I ripped out something perhaps rather rash, quite innocent though, but to use an expression more striking than classic, it settled my hash, and proved very soon the last act of our session. Fiddlesticks it is, sir. I wonder the ceiling doesn't fall down and crush you. Oh, you men have no feeling, you selfish, unnatural, illiberal creatures who set yourselves up as patterns and preachers. You silly pretense, why, what a mere guess it is. Pray, what do you know of a woman's necessities? I've told you and shown you I've nothing to wear, and it's perfectly plain you not only don't care, but you do not believe me. Here the nose went still higher. I suppose if you dared, you would call me a liar. Our engagement is ended, sir. Yes, on the spot. You're a brute and a monster, and I don't know what. I mildly suggested the words Hottentot, pickpocket and cannibal, Tartar and chief, as gentle expletives which might give relief. But this only proved a spark to the powder, and the storm I had raised came faster and louder. It blew and it rained, thundered, lightened, and hailed, interjections, verbs, pronouns, till language quite failed to express the abusive, and then its arrears were brought up at all once by a torrent of tears, and my last faint, despairing attempt at an observation was lost in a tempest of sobs. Well, I felt for the lady and felt for my hat, too, improvised on the crown of the latter a tattoo, in lieu of expressing the feelings which lay quite too deep for words, as Wordsworth would say. Then, without going through the form of a bow, found myself in the entry, I hardly knew how, on doorstep and sidewalk, past lamppost and square, at home and upstairs and in my own easy chair. Poked my feet into slippers, my fire into blaze, and said to myself as I lit my cigar, supposing a man had the wealth of the Tsar, of the Russias to boot for the rest of his days, on the whole do you think he would have much to spare if he married a woman with nothing to wear? Since that night, taking pains that it should not be bruited, abroad in society I've instituted a course of inquiry extensive and thorough on this vital subject, and find, to my horror, that the fair Flora's case is by no means surprising, but that there exists the greatest distress in our female community, solely arising from this unsupplied destitution of dress, whose unfortunate victims are filling the air with the pitiful wail of nothing to wear. Researches in some of the upper 10 districts reveal the most painful and startling statistics, of which let me mention only a few. In one single house on 5th Avenue, 3 young ladies were found all below 22, who have been there 3 whole weeks without anything new in the way of flounced silks, and thus left in the lurch, are unable to go to ball, concert, or church. In another large mansion near the same place was found a deplorable, heart-rending case of an entire destitution of Brussels pointless. In a neighboring block there was found in 3 calls total want long continued of camel's hair shawls, and a suffering family whose case exhibits the most pressing needs of real ermine tippets. One deserving young lady, almost unable to survive for the want of a new Russian sable. Another confined to the house when it's windier than usual because her shawl was in India. Still another whose tortures have been most terrific ever since the sad loss of the steamer Pacific, in which were engulfed not friend or relation, for whose fate she perhaps might have found consolation, or borne it at least with serene resignation. But the choicest assortment of French sleeves and collars ever sent out from Paris worth thousands of dollars, and all as to style most recherché and rare, the want of which leaves her with nothing to wear, and renders her life so drear and dyspeptic, and she's quite a recluse and almost a septic, for she touchingly says that this sort of grief cannot find in religion the slightest relief, and philosophy has not a maxim to spare for the victims of such overwhelming despair. But the saddest by far of all these sad features is the cruelty practiced upon the poor creatures by husbands and fathers, real Bluebeards and Timmons, whose resist the most touch peals made for diamonds by their wives and their daughters, and leave them for days unsupplied with new jewelry, fans, or bouquets. Even laugh at their miseries whenever they have a chance, and deride their demands as useless extravagance. One case of a bride was brought to my view, too sad for belief, but alas, 'twas too true, whose husband refused, as savage as Charon, to permit her to take more than 10 trunks to Sharon. The consequence was that when she got there, at the end of 3 weeks, she had nothing to wear, and when she proposed to finish the season at Newport, the monster refused out and out for his infamous conduct, alleging no reason, except that the waters were good for his gout. Such treatment as this was too shocking, of course, and proceedings are now going on for a divorce. But why harrow the feelings by lifting the curtain? From these scenes of woe enough, it is certain, was here been disclosed to stir up the pity of every benevolent heart in the city, and spur up humanity into a canter, to rush and relieve these sad cases instanter. Won't somebody moved by this touching description come forward tomorrow and head a subscription? Won't some kind philanthropist, seeing that aid is so needed at once by these indignant ladies, take charge of the matter? Or won't Peter Cooper, the cornerstone lay of some splendid superstructure like that which today links his name in a union unending of honor and fame, and found a new charity just for the care of these unhappy women with nothing to wear? Which is view of the cash which would daily be claimed, the laying out hospital well might be named. Won't Stewart or some of our dry goods importers take a contract for clothing our wives and our daughters, or to furnish the cash to supply these distresses, and life's pathway strew with shawls, collars, and dresses, ere the want of them makes it much rougher and thornier, won't someone discover a new California? And oh, if perchance there should be a sphere where all is made right which so puzzles us here, where the glare and glitter and tinsel of time fade and die in the light of that region sublime, where the soul disenchanted of flesh and of sense, unscreened by its trappings and shows and pretense, must be clothed for the life and the service above, with purity, truth, faith, meekness, and love. O daughters of earth, foolish virgins, beware, lest in that upper realm you have nothing to wear. This has been Jennifer Love, reading to you some poetry and prose.